evening, everyone, and welcome to the Auckland Cricket Podcast. We're sitting here in quite the unusual position of reflecting on a New Zealand victory by actually quite a huge margin. And most people have caught up with Ross Taylor's amazing innings, and we'll get everybody to just talk about that in a second, but I'm going to just bust out a couple of stats just to set the tone for it, I guess. If you hadn't seen it, Ross Taylor and Jacob Boreham shared a partnership of 85 off 21 deliveries. That's a strike rate of 400, I believe, per ball for that partnership. They also went, and this is basically what their partnership was, but just to put it into a perspective of how your overs pan out, when McCullum got out at 6 for 210, that was 45.5 overs gone. And let's see, that's 22 balls later, they were on 295 for 7 when Oram holed out.
Yeah, just to add to that, Andy Zaltzman on Crick Info said that if they had continued to go at that strike rate, the strike rate that they had for the last four overs for the whole innings, they would have scored 1,159 runs.
Which would have been useful. Yeah. It was amazing stuff, though, wasn't it? I mean, I don't think I've seen a hitting that big and that consistent ever before, actually.
I don't think I've seen bowling that consistently bad. Six waist-high full tosses in a row.
I know, and I'm going to get onto that in a second, but I wanted us to just revel in Ross Taylor's magnificence for a minute, because we don't often get to sit around and say, wasn't that amazing? Black cap scoring 100, a big 100. What, he scored 62. His last 62 came off 16 balls, which is quite frankly ridiculous.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, you know, he should have been out for zero, all well and good, but to then, you know, make the most of his chance and scratch around for most of his innings, which he did, but kind of get through the difficult time, and then just in those last few overs just open his shoulders and everything came out of the middle of the bat. It was pretty amazing.
You think, I mean, we've always talked about Brendan McCullum as being the master blaster and the man who can destroy bowling attacks, and he scored the first 20/20 in that IPL, but anything that Ross Taylor's well and truly taken over from him, and being, you know, when you want somebody who's going to hit the ball out of the park on a consistent basis and can absolutely boom it, he's sort of stepped ahead of McCullum in that regard.
Well, personally, I think there's probably three or four guys in that lineup that on their day, actually probably more than three or four, that on their day can be the guy who comes off, and it just happened to be Taylor, you know, this time. But obviously he is rated as someone who can boom it out of the park probably more regularly than others, which is why he gets, you know, such a big salary at the IPL.
Yeah, he's long been touted as our premier batsman. I think one of the reasons for that is that he has shown in the IPL with his 2020 side that he can hit it out of the park at will. And he's shown for New Zealand in the test side that he's an impeccable batsman when he's in form. I think McCullum, if you go back to that 113 that he scored against Australia in a 2020, he's an entirely different kind of batsman. He'll ramp it over the wicketkeeper's head. He'll do commando rolls sideways and trying to get the bat on the ball so that it flies over fine leg for six. He's just looking for runs any way he can get them. So they're two very different batsmen. And I think Taylor, although he was gifted his wicket and he was gifted a lot of horrible deliveries towards the end, he hopefully has come back into some form and will show that he can play some great cricket shots.
Sorely needed, I think, for him. Absolutely. It was kind of like watching baseball at times, really, wasn't it? Because there were all these, you know, full tosses about roughly waist high, and he was just swinging from the hip and they were all disappearing over into the bleachers or whatever they call them on baseball. It was fantastic stuff. Okay, let's try and step back a wee bit then from salivating over Ross Taylor and the performance, and say, put it in a wee bit of objectivity here, and say that was pretty awful bowling at the end by Pakistan, wasn't it? I mean, to go from 200 to 300 in the space of the last five overs is pretty outrageous stuff. And then they fell over when we did bowl well, admittedly. What can we take out of the victory? How much worth can we put in the performance?
I reckon we still take heaps out of it. Sure, the bowling was complete and utter crap, but I suppose as a batsman, you can still only, you know, face what's given to you, and the batsman still had to put the ball over the rope as such. And the fact that Taylor and Norum and McCullum and whoever did it so consistently is awesome. You know, you should be easy enough to maybe hit one or two of those away and then sky another. So I reckon we take that out of it, even though, yeah, the bowling was completely terrible. Man, on the flip side, with our bowling, there was a period there when Razak and Gul were together that, you know, yeah, looked like, I don't know, it could have almost gone awry there. But I think part of that was the fact that one, Vittoria was injured, and because of that, we had to use. Was it Saldi, Mills, and, you know, Oram? Had to get them more overs earlier than what we may usually have. And Styrus and Franklin had to bowl more than what they might have. So overall, I think, yeah, it was hugely encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, we knocked off the only unbeaten side in the World Cup at that stage. And we've absolutely smashed their confidence, I have no doubt. So we can take a lot from it. It's a job well done. It's no small feat.
And I think, I mean, you can look at it and say the bowling was awful, and it was, but I think it was an accumulation of things. Obviously, those two drop catches had, you know, caused a huge amount of frustration and earlier on in the innings, and a couple of half-decent partnerships with Scott Styrus in particular probably added to that frustration. And then McCullum joined Taylor, and it was actually McCullum who got things moving initially by launching two sixes off what were probably not too bad of deliveries. They certainly weren't waist-high full tosses anyway. And you could almost, you almost got the feeling that Pakistan were, you know, the frustration and the whatever was starting to build, and then they suddenly started, you know, bowling full tosses. But even so, like, I remember not so long ago, a fast full toss was considered like quite a good delivery. Bowlers were actually using it as a tactic. But the fact that our guys just middled every single one of them.
Yeah, towards out the of end. The park, when Ross Taylor got his first couple of waist-high full tosses, they were coming from Shoaib Akhtar, so they're probably coming at about 140 km.
Mm.
His hand speed, his bat speed was just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and I guess you could say that he earned some of those waist-high full tosses by what he was doing with the ball, sending it over the rope. You create pressure by putting, you know, putting runs on the board and scoring boundaries, don't you? So bowlers then have to react to that. So. Mm.
And think back to, you know, any other great one-day innings that you've seen in the past. You don't remember what the bowling was like. You know, when Matty Hayden got 180 against us, I think in Hamilton or Napier, and we chased it down when they got over 300. I mean, no one remembers what the Kiwi bowling was like. They just remember that
we won.
But that, you know, he just blasted us all over the park, and it was a fantastic innings. Same with Tendulkar's 200. Like, no one remembers South Africa's bowlers being awful, which I'm sure they were. They probably contributed to it. And I think same with this innings of Taylor. If they'll remember anything, they may remember the drop catches, but, you know, they'll just remember Taylor's amazing hitting.
That's the good thing about the way that he ended the innings, because if he had just dawdled to 70 or 80 after having been given a couple or three lives, he might not have had the kind of confidence that he's taken from it now. New Zealand as a team might not have taken as much confidence from it.
Okay.
It looked scratched for the majority of his innings.
Yeah, I mean, fantastic that he got there. Let's talk about those catches then briefly, because got an awful lot of attention. First one was a yours, no yours type affair between wicketkeeper and first slip, which, you know, I guess does happen now and again, although you'd have to say it was a keeper's catch. It was easily diveable to get to. The second one, a wee bit harder to explain, I would have said. It almost, like, I watched it in slow-mo, and it's like he's actually brought his hands together too quickly, and he's getting it on the tips of his fingers, which is a incredibly simple mistake for an international keeper to make when there was just a small edge, just had to move across for his gloves. I mean, can somebody be really that bad at international level to drop catches like that? Or how do you spot fix a drop catch? I don't know. I haven't figured that one out.
Well, he's been that bad before, hasn't he?
He has, unfortunately, yeah.
Against, was it Michael Hussey? He basically saved Michael Hussey's career by dropping him a couple of times in that Test match series in Aussie a couple of years ago. And now he's, well, I wouldn't say he's saved Ross Taylor's career, but, you know, there was certainly murmurs about him being starting to be questioning his spot on the side because he hasn't scored runs for so long. So, I don't know. Yeah, he can be that bad, it would seem.
I guess he wasn't alone, and that, you know, there were those ridiculous four overthrows from Shoaib Akhtar when he wildly threw it back to the keeper and missed by about a good 5 metres over his head. And then there was one out to the boundary, which
Yunus Khan
was, it's like watching 7-year-olds trying to field on the boundary. It was just, didn't even really have a go at all. And Pakistan, I guess, can be like that in the field there. But yeah, I guess, you know, we can't ask those questions unless we talk about, say, South Africa versus England and say, were South Africa involved in spot fixing as well? Because that has got to be one of the all-time chokes of a World Cup. They were cruising. They need, what, another 30, 40 runs, I think, for victory, with 3 wickets down. Yeah, I mean, have they decided to choke early this time in the round robin rather than the knockout games, or do we think this is just a blip?
Yeah, it was quite amazing. That's one of the only games that I've watched, actually got to see the majority of it on TV, thanks to a wonderful motel in Palmerston North with Sky in my bedroom. But I don't think it was a choke. I just think England got a sniff, and they bowled really well right from the start. And they just created a whole bunch of pressure. And it was one of those pitches where it was low and slow and giving a bit of turn. And it was really hard to score on. And it's one of those pitches that when one guy gets out, you know, you're never really in on it. But one wicket can lead to two, can lead to three, can lead to four. And that's kind of what happened. It almost felt like it was going to happen. Mm. It just had that kind of feel about it, that they were always going to get out. And the bowlers really had it on a string, especially Swan. He only got one wicket, but man, he was hot.
He was all over Graham Smith.
Yeah,
that was pretty cool to watch.
Yeah.
But I feel like a complete dunce because after those games, because I picked South Africa and Pakistan for the World Cup final. So
it's a long way to go.
Could still happen. And who would have picked after our game? We were top of our pool and England were top of their group, I think.
Yeah,
who
I mean, Australia's still got to play their game to catch up, but it's still quite nice to look at New Zealand sitting on top of the points table. And even if Australia win, which they probably will, they'll only be 1 point behind them after four games. Yeah, not many people would have been picking that after the Pakistan home series, I guess. Interesting days. Just on to finish up that whole Cameron Akmal debacle, shall we call it. There's a couple of quotes floating around which are quite good. Ian Chappell, who's never shy of making controversial statements, said that if his batting was as good as Don Bradman's, he still couldn't score enough runs to make up for his wicket-keeping Cameron Akmal, which is quite bold. But I thought the beautiful one was in reply to a reporter's comment, which said that the reporter said that there was a comparison between Cameron Akmal and Michael Jackson because they both wore gloves for no good reason. And Waka Yunus replied, "The difference between them is that one is dead." Which is succinct and to the point, I guess, really. That's the way to kill any further conjecture on that one. Well, while we're just talking about the World Cup still and what's been going on, I just was sort of noticing in that it was the beginning of the Pakistan innings, and I think it was either the first or the second wicket, and went up to a referral. And there's still this, I see, as an anomaly between when somebody's given out and when somebody's given not out, and therefore what they can then decide upon when they go upstairs. So if you're given not out and the ball's within half a ball is just going to clip the stump, then they can't give that out because it's too close to call. But if it goes the other way and he's given out and it hits within half a ball, he can
stay with that decision.
Does that make sense?
Well, I don't think that they are that confident in the technology that it's to the millimetre correct, and they still incorporate the whole benefit of the doubt scenario.
But if you're going to do that, you've got to incorporate it both ways, surely.
I think it feels to me like it's benefit of the doubt to the umpire.
Yeah.
So they're trying to have as little as possible umpires' decisions overturned. Because if every LBW that the umpires make, you know, are getting changed, then the umpires are going to look like a complete waste of time. So they've manipulated it in such a way that less decisions are going to be changed. So if someone's initially given out, then the rules around the technology are a little bit more lax to say that if it's only just nicking the stumps on replay, then yeah, we'll stick with the original decision. And then, like you say, the other way around, if he's given not out, then, you know, it's really got to be clear that it's hitting the stumps for them to overturn that decision. So it's, in a sense, protecting the umpires a little bit, which I can kind of understand, because if we did get to the situation where a whole heap were getting overturned, then it would kind of be like, why do we have umpires?
You see in rugby union and rugby league, if they go to the third umpire, on occasion the third umpire will not be able to determine precisely what's happened through replays, and they'll give it back to the umpire for an on-field call. I think it's a similar kind of situation.
Mm.
They're not that confident in the technology that they know exactly what would have happened, so they leave it as an on-field call.
You think, though, that over time that whole benefit of the doubt thing might start to actually be eroded as a sort of a standard because technology becomes more and more accurate and more prevalent in terms of assisting with decision-making?
Yeah, I think so. It's the way of all sport, you know, that uses technology. I mean, tennis is the classic example. They don't get any of that stuff wrong now, well, because of the technology. So
it's taken as being 100% accurate, whether it actually is or not, isn't it?
Mm.
But it's assumed that that's the case.
The only thing that they need to work on is the speed of it, because sometimes with those close ones, they're still taking a little bit of time about it, whereas the tennis ones are just, you know, you see one replay and the crowd gets into it.
But tennis has the advantage of having no external influences on
it,
does it?
True.
There's no bodies in the way, there's, you know, no angles to be played with. It's just like, bang, there it is, do it. I mean, rugby and league have the same issue, don't they? They, you know, people whinge about how long it takes because there's five bodies and you have to get the right camera angle, etc. Cricket's not quite to that extent, but it still has some of the same issues, which you're only ever going to get so fast on some decisions.
Yeah. I actually quite like the fact that they don't, even though I like hotspot, that they're relying just on the pictures that they're seeing on the replays. Like there was the Graham Smith wicket the other night where it only just grazed his glove, and they played replay after replay, and all they could go on was there was a slight vibration in the glove as the ball went past, which was fantastic. It was actually really riveting viewing, I found, and it was quite clear if you watch it close enough that it had flicked his glove. Part of me almost thinks that that's kind of the way to go, that they're literally using what the umpire saw but just kind of slowing it down, and yeah, they're getting slightly different angles and whatnot. But I almost prefer that to using some of that other crazy technology that the Aussies use with Hotspot and Sneeko and all that stuff.
Yeah. Conversely, in that same England-South Africa game, it was quite cool to see a moment when Jacques Cullis nicked one behind, and it just barely reached Matt Prior's gloves, and it was given out by the umpire. And Jacques Cullis just turned around to Matt Prior and asked him if he'd actually caught it. Matt Prior said that he did, so he walked off rather than taking
a
review.
It was a bit of a kind of old school.
Yeah, that's a
cricket
camaraderie,
isn't
it? Maybe Jacques Cullis is of the Adam Gilchrist
old
school of cricket playing. Yeah, interesting stuff. All right, anything else we want to talk about the World Cup, Neil, associate trivia that you want to bring forth or anything like that?
Nothing in that respect. The one thing that really annoys me with the UDRS, actually, just while we're on it, I'll be interested in getting your guys' opinions on it. Obviously, every time someone refers something, the first thing they do is check for a no ball. Now, if that wasn't referred and the batsman hit it for six, then if it's a no ball, he should be getting another, you know, a free hit or whatever. But the fact that it's gone upstairs, if it is a no ball, the umpire screwed it up, not the bowler, not the batsman. And if it's a no ball, then the, you know, bowler could be essentially robbed off a wicket, where if the technology wasn't in place and the umpire hadn't seen the no ball and given a nod out or out, you know, you carry on with it. And then there's a chance that the bowling team might waste a referral as well because of an umpire error and missing the no ball in the first place, which I reckon is completely wrong if the umpire doesn't see the no ball to start off with. Similar
they shouldn't lose a review.
Yeah, like similar to rugby, in that if there's a forward pass thrown in the field of play, the third umpire can't rule on it. If the touch judges and umpire miss it, it's their fault. So, you know, why should the team be penalised for that? So what do you guys reckon?
I reckon you're overcomplicating things.
My head was actually spinning as you were talking there,
no,
trying to follow. But
I've thought the same, actually. Not quite as in-depth as you've thought about it. But I have thought it just, it doesn't quite seem to fit with what they're actually reviewing. Because they're reviewing the umpire's decision or what's happening with the wicket. So therefore, why should they go back to the overstepping or not?
Yeah, it's like the try that we got off Benji Marshall's forward pass to Jason Nightingale in the Kiwis Four Nations final.
Yeah, that was horrendous. Yeah, no, it's a very good point, actually. I think I sort of hadn't thought of it that way. I just thought that they check every legal aspect of the delivery, which is what they're doing. But you're right.
Are they checking the bowler's arm as well?
Yeah, exactly. So they're not. They really should be checking what.
Yeah.
Bit in question is in question in terms of the dismissal rather than the entirety of the dismissal, and that's just that human error element, I suppose, in terms of the umpire not getting it right.
And then if you're gonna, as you say, 15 degrees, you check how many fielders are in the circle.
Yeah, are there three behind square on the leg side?
Do they have two catches? Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah, if you're gonna check one aspect of the no ball, you might as well check all of them. Just get rid of it.
Dan, hope you're listening, ICC.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. So I was just looking at draw, and Canada versus Kenya. Huge upset, surely.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you set the mice guy for it. Yeah.
Oh, right. No.
What, Canada to win?
Canada beat them.
Oh, right.
that the game was a couple of nights ago. Yeah. But
that's a huge upset these
Kenya
days.
Kenya
really?
Were
so, yeah.
awful.
They were.
They were so awful. Their batting was just abysmal.
Talking of abysmal batting, Bangladesh. I saw the end of that and I couldn't actually believe what I was seeing. It was just appalling.
Mm-hmm.
They've gone from, you know, potential threats in this tournament to almost feeling like one of the minnows again.
Yeah. They're also rans at this stage, aren't they?
It's bizarre.
Well, that was one game. I wouldn't expect them to do that again by any means.
But they only just scraped past, who was it? One of the other associates in an earlier game.
Yeah.
Ireland, wasn't it?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, India only just scraped past Netherlands. It's some of these big teams are not really going for the jugular when they're playing the minnows. Not like New Zealand, who have absolutely smashed every minnow that they've played. But
that's because we can't afford to take anybody not totally seriously, I think. All right, I think we've probably just about covered every aspect of the World Cup that we can at this point in time, while people are still going to be listening. So we're going to move on to some domestic cricket, and really only need to say one thing here, 46. Mm. Where to from here for the Aces? That is the second lowest score, I believe, that we've ever posted. It's kind of hard to imagine what could be lower than that. And we'll sidetrack slightly and say, how bad must the guys be in 1977 who got out for 13, which is the lowest all-time Auckland score?
And
pretty
first class score in New Zealand, for that matter.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're hard-pressed to get lower.
Yep.
So. Okay, anyway, back to 46. Can you just write that off and say, that's just one of those days where everything went wrong?
Yeah, and the immortal words of one of the All Blacks coaches, flush the dunny and move on, I think. I don't think I've ever seen, I mean, I've seen some low scores in my time. I'm a New Zealand cricket fan. But I don't think I've ever seen an innings where not a single person has got into double figures and the highest score is 8.
High score is extras with 9.
Ah,
yeah.
There you go.
It was also over incredibly quickly. It was 18 point something overs. Like, nobody even managed to sort of hang around and dig in and but still only get half a dozen or whatever. It was all just ping, 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 gone. And we were 30-odd for 3. It's very strange stuff. Probably just as worrying is that we're now 6 rounds into the competition and we have a grand total of 2 points. So I think it's probably fair to say that our chances of victory in the 4-day competition have gone into the distance. So what's left to salvage from the season from here, do you reckon?
Not a hell of a lot, really, truth be told. Even if we win the last 2 games, you know, who cares? We'll still probably finish 4, sure. Yeah, well, in that case, you know, could finish mid-table potentially. But yeah, I mean, in the immortal words of Ricky Bobby, if you're not first, you're last. So yeah,
that is true philosophy. Yeah, it's got to be. I guess got to be about mid-table respectability, doesn't it? At this point, it's dragging ourselves up and getting a few wins and getting yourself off the bottom.
I mean, I think the only things that we can salvage from the season are possibly to blood some of these guys who've been on the fringe. You know, obviously Jimmy Neesham's already played a couple of games, but persevere with him. Maybe get Carl Kachopa into the side.
Craig,
that's what I meant.
To have Carl.
Yeah. How wasn't he 12th man for the opposition?
Yes.
Sorry.
CD.
Yeah, CD. Yeah, Craig Kachopa in. Yeah, and just give some of these younger guys maybe a chance. Just to kind of build up stocks for next year. Isn't it funny though, like a month ago after we'd kind of won the one day in the HIV Cup, we're talking about, oh god, what a tough decision with contracts for next year. We've got so many amazing players floating around, blah blah blah. Now it's like, who would you give a contract to?
But at the same time, I mean, these guys haven't become crap players, have they?
No.
They just haven't figured out 4-day cricket for whatever reason. And you've still got young guys in there, like, you know, Colin de Grandhomme's still a young guy, Andy de Border, Jeet Raval. And I see here what you're saying about blooding young players. I think we've got plenty in there already, actually. Mm. It's just a case of those guys. And, you know, Dutchie's now played 3-4 seasons of first-class cricket. Andy Border's in his second, almost third, really, and Jeet's in his second. So their guys have been around long enough, really, to have sort of figured their game out, that they should be performing at that level. And to be fair to Andy de Border, actually, he's one of the guys who has been sticking his hand up and scoring runs at 4-day level. But yeah, be interesting to see what happens in the last few games. You've got ND, I think, coming up on Monday, who turned them over just a couple of weeks ago, so that will be a good chance to hopefully right the ship, get back on track, and yeah, potentially finish off like they did last summer, where they came back and won, I think, 2 or 3 outrights in a row to finish off the season. So
still love you, by the way, boys, and we'll support you in every match in case, I don't know, one of you may have listen to one of these podcasts at some stage
around,
in history.
You can't sit around saying the boys are awesome after they've scored 46, even when you know them all. It's not possible. So they know they've got to do better than that.
Love you, don't like you.
Right, there is only 3 days of club cricket left. It was in a complete washout last weekend, funnily enough. So not much to talk about there. So we'll catch up on what does happen in the second to last round of the two-day stuff. Next week, we will also be getting, God, let's hope, to the near final stages of the World Cup by next week. No, we'll still have about 4 weeks to go, won't we? But anyway, we'll be getting slightly closer. We'll be near the end of pool play, I think. So plenty to talk about there as well. And in the meantime, hopefully we will do a podcast next week. I might not be here, but hopefully the rest of you guys will be.
Oh, we'll have to work out the technology.
It will be exciting times. Anyway, listeners, thanks for tuning in, and we will catch you in 7 days' time.